church work in Cambodia, and in the course of that experience learned lessons that she has subsequently determined she wants to share. So much of her time she spends encouraging people to avoid unhealthy dependency. Anyway, beyond that, I'll allow Jean to introduce herself and to share that which God has put on her heart. Welcome, Jean.
What I love about this conference is that we're all on a learning curve, and we are learning together, and we're all in different places in the journey. And I just want you to know, excuse me, I do have a cold, so it might be rough going a little bit. I had spent, as I shared before, 6 years working among Cambodian refugees in America. And so when I went to Cambodia, I already spoke the language. And my second day in Cambodia, John, you'll appreciate this, I was walking with a Cambodian friend, and I heard this deep guttural sound. And I turned to my Cambodian friend, and I said, "Wow, that's what monks sound like when they chant. I've always wondered when you come to the temple, Buddhist temples, what monks sound like when they're chanting." And her eyes got really big, and she turned to me and she said, "Jean?" I said, "Yes." "Jean, those aren't monks, those are frogs." Okay, so when I went to Cambodia, I had a lot to learn. If you read my book, We Are Not the Hero, it's taking a look at my own mistakes and things that I did wrong and learned from, and then adapted, and how I adapted. This evening we have some guests, so I want to refer to the slide behind me. This conference is called Through the Eyes of Vulnerable Mission. For our guests, how are we defining vulnerable mission? The slide says that AVM, Alliance for Vulnerable Mission, believes that some Western missionaries should carry out their key ministry outside of the West using local languages and resources. So I hope, God willing, that I will make some of that, I'll put some flesh on the bones of that. And that's my goal. You know, we've talked, sometimes I feel like what's happening here is we're having the Council of Jerusalem. Why do you think I say that? Now, not everybody's been here, but some of you have been here for 2 days, and I feel like in some ways we're having the Council of Jerusalem. Why do you think I'm saying that? Any thoughts? Were you sitting? No? Because in the Council of Jerusalem, in the Bible, what were they doing? They were discussing what? Paul went out as a missionary. He was out sharing the gospel with other people groups, Gentiles. But then they begin to run into some issues. Isn't that what we've been talking about the whole time we've been here? Issues. And some of their discussion was about what? How much should we make the Gentiles become Jews to become followers of Jesus Christ? And in some ways, isn't that what we're doing? How much do we have to make, for example, myself from Cambodia, how much do we have to make the Cambodians, Westerners, to become followers of Jesus? And I think that's what we're trying to figure out. Because in this global world, it's very complicated. Because in some ways, I would say, frantically with Paul, I don't want to make other nations become like an American to become a follower of Jesus. But with globalization, some people are saying it's a little different than the Council of Jerusalem, because where the Gentiles were not wanting to speak Hebrew, we have a wide open world right now where it seems that people are saying in Africa, we want to speak English. we want to sing hip hop. We want to be like you. And so we have some very complicated issues that we're trying to sort out as cross-cultural communicators. So this is sort of the Council of Jerusalem. How do we do that as Western missionaries, going among those who are not followers of Jesus, and bring them to Jesus without making them into Western Christians? Why is Gene Johnson so passionate about unhealthy dependency? Because I think it's such a fun topic. And I love talking about what we should do or not do with our money. Not. But when I was in Cambodia, I'm going to take this because I need to illustrate something. Can I have three people come up here, please? Come forth, run quickly, unless you want to go to bed late. Go to bed without tea. It's not a good thing, so come. We got three. Okay. Do you have a piece of paper handy? Would you just put a dollar sign on it? I'm going to speak behalf of America. Yeah, big old dollar sign. Not quid, but dollars. I'm actually going to pass it on to this dude.
I'm the American
nice,
up here.
Nice try, Jim. Actually, how do I want to do this? So, Terry, you are a non-believing Cambodian. Okay? You're a Buddhist. Very good. Oh, do that again. Very good. And Jim, you are a Cambodian believer in Jesus Christ.
So I don't pray.
I don't know. That's up to you. Depends what church you go to and how all your Christianity has come about. And then there's John.
Yeehaw!
That's right. He is the one who provides Jim as a Cambodian. Jim has told him, yes, I want to go and share the gospel in Cambodia. Getting ahead of yourself. You rude British. You're supposed to be Cambodian. They're very gentle and very, yes, much better. So Jim says, oh, missionary, I would love to share the gospel, but I don't have any transportation. And if only I had some money, I could not work my job so that I could share the gospel full time, and I could also use a motorcycle. Would you be willing to help me with these ministry tools so that I can share the gospel with a non-believing Cambodian? So he goes, and you know him. He's from the village over, and when he used to come on an old bicycle. And the sad thing is, on his bicycle, everybody knows him because they said, that's the man who rides the bicycle that the chain keeps falling off. So he has to stop every 10 minutes and put the chain back on. But today, he arrives on a motorcycle. And he comes for the first time to tell you about the good news of Jesus Christ. Now, what happens in Cambodia is two things. This is reality. I'm not making this up. Do you know the number one question a non-believing Cambodian would ask a believing Cambodian when they shared the gospel? You'd think it would be about Buddhism. Oh, wasn't Buddha born before Jesus? So how can Jesus be God? No. The first question is, oh, yeah, where did you get the motorbike? And can you get me a motorbike too? Even more accurately, Cambodians would say this. When I was working along church planners and they came back and I said, how did it go? They said, well, Jean, you know, the first question out of their mouth was, how much money do you get to do this? And can you get me a job too? So what do you think that does to the gospel? The credibility of the message and the messenger. Two things. You'll end up doing two things. Yes, get me a job too, because I want to be in on Christianity for the benefits I can get. Or two, you are a foreign agent of a foreign religion. Why should I believe in a religion that you can't even pay for, but you have to get somebody from America? So the second reaction is, Jesus is the foreigner's God. Okay, thank you. So I became very concerned with, did I maybe knock it off or something? Thank you. I became very concerned with outside resources coming into the equation, because it inevitably led to two things. I want in on Christianity. I want in on being with Jesus because of the material benefits that I can get. Or secondly, I don't want anything to do with Jesus because you're a hireling of the foreigners and they're paying you, and I want nothing to do with it. This is what you find in the Buddhist world. This is what you find in the Muslim world. Now, I don't know. I haven't been to Latin America, and there are different. They have the Catholic backgrounds and whatnot. But when you go to the unreached people blocks of the world, that's what you're going to find. What I'd like to share tonight is about ethics of change. Okay. For example, what if? Where did the cell phone? Do you know where the cell phone started and was invented? Who came up with the cell phone? Does anyone know? Good, I don't know either, so I'm going to make it up. What's that? Mobile phone. I assume that it probably started in America, or at least in the West, right? Phones were not, I don't think the mobile phone was invented in Cambodia. I doubt it was invented in Turkey. I doubt it was invented in Uganda. It was in Uganda? It was in... Okay, good, okay. It scared me. It's like, what? I better sit down right away. I'm confused. But let's say we invent and we make the cell phone, and it's a good thing initially. You know, it's a great thing, and we promote it all over the world, because we have. Just like Coca-Cola has reached the farthest points of the world, the mobile phone has as well. But what if 15 years from now, we find out that this mobile phone that we invented in America and spread all over the world actually causes brain cancer for anybody that uses it 10 years or more. And we turn around at the end of the day and we look back and we see what I created and what I made has changed the world. The mobile phone has changed the world. But what if, after 10 or 15 years, we realize we made a Frankenstein? We made a mistake. That it actually is going to cause more harm than good. That's what ethics of change are. Ethics of change means we have an ethical responsibility for the overall big pictures that we create around the world. I don't know if this is true. I read it in a book, and I'm a bit leery to use it because I've been to Uganda, but I don't know much about the African world. But I did read in a book that long time ago, into the lakes of Uganda, from the outside, they decided to introduce a hyacinth plant. How do you pronounce it? Hyacinth, yeah. A hyacinth plant. Taking it from an outside context and put it into the waters of Uganda, which has never been done before. So they did it. Beautiful plant. Flowering plant, beautiful. But over the years, as that plant grew, the root system grew so aggressively and so wild that it shut down the waterways. It backfired. It ruined the fishing life, the commercial life of boats. Everything came to a standstill. And to this day, they're still trying to fight that weed. And even to fight the weed, they had to call the outsiders, in some ways, that brought the plant in the first place to come and try to figure out how to get rid of this terrible thing. Because it was ruining their economy. I mean, fishermen had to stop short. Boats stopped. Everything stopped and began to destroy their livelihood. Ethics of change. What does that have to do with missions? Hope I can do this with the... There is a missionary by the name of Jacob Lowen, and he was teaching in India. And why he was in India, he was teaching a group of people made up of two sets of participants. One were Indians, locals, and some were, I believe they were American missionaries, colleagues. And he was teaching on the topic of world view. If you want to flip the word, just call it how we view the world, world view. And the way he taught on world view is that he drew an ox cart wheel. So he's just trying to teach, what does worldview mean? He told the participants that worldview is like a wheel. And at the hub of the wheel is the center of our worldview. This is what we value the most. This is what drives the spokes, which is how you live out your worldview on a daily basis. So he wasn't sure if everyone was following his example. So he asked the Indian participants, what is your missionary colleague's center of their hub, center of life? And in unison, almost immediately, the Indian locals said, this is the center of the missionary's worldview. So then he began to ask them, he said, why do you say that? And the Indians began to say, because of this, because of this, because of this. They gave live examples. And it was obvious by the time they were done sharing that money was at the center of the value system, at the heart of the life and ministry of American missionaries. So he went on. He said, okay, let me ask you another question. Now he was speaking to the Indians. If your parents and grandparents had, before the white man came, okay, the white man is the one who came with the gospel. Before the white man came, what was at the center of the wheel? And they said at the center, for our parents and grandparents, it was war. And he said, why war? Why was war what drove the people, what drove your parents and grandparents? And they said, because our parents and grandparents went to war, because when they kill somebody, they get spirit power. And that's what drove the center of their life and activity is they went to war so they could get the spirit power. For everyone they killed, they got more spirit power. So then the Indian participants began to talk among themselves, and they said, well, no, then Jacob, the teacher, said, is it possible then that it wasn't war that was driving them, but the desire for spirit power? And they agreed, yes, war was the vehicle to get spirit power. And then they began to say, you know what, Jacob, to the teacher? If our parents and grandparents had become believers in Jesus Christ, you know what would have been at the center? The Spirit of God. And then he asked, so for you today, what is at the center? The Spirit of God? They said no. They said what it is at the center is money. How does that lead to ethics of change? What I'm trying to share with you is that when we come in with our seemingly superior language and all of our outside resources, and we bring the gospel with boatloads and boatloads, plane loads and plane loads, pocket loads, purses filled with money, and everything we're doing, giving the gospel, whatever it is, we put a lot of money into it. It begins to look like what drives us, what is the key to our success, why we're such great church planters, why we can make disciples faster than anybody else, is because we are empowered by money. But isn't it Jesus who said, wait in Jerusalem for the Holy Spirit? And Chris Little does a lot of writing on unhealthy dependency, and he says this: one must have a lot of capital to do Christianity the Western style. So we have, in some ways, led the world to believe that our success to ministry, our success to church planning, our success to making disciples and evangelizing is because we have money. So for them to be successful in all the places around the world, they have to get what drives us is money. Yet I'm fearful that at the end of the day, as missionaries and cross-cultural communicators and churches, if we turn around 30 years from now and we see that that's what they think is the crux of Christianity and how to grow it and spread it and spontaneous multiplication, that we might realize that we're responsible for ethics of change. I want to read something by an African gentleman from Nairobi, Oscar Muru. This is what he says. I've heard him say it, but on a video. And he's an African local, a Kenyan, and this is what he's telling the mission, he's telling us. These are his words to us. He says, you Westerners, you Americans, you have an amazing capacity to resolve problems. Now, it's a great thing about Americans, the ability to innovate and to resolve problems. The downside of that is that when you come to our context, you don't know how to live with our problems. You see our poverty. You see our need. You see the places we are hurting. And you have great compassion to come and solve us. But life can't be solved that way. Many times, well-intentioned Americans will come into our context and they try to fix my life. You can't fix my life. What I need is a covenant. Not really. What I need is a brother who comes and gives me a shoulder to cry on and gives me space to express my pain but doesn't try to fix me. When Jesus comes into the world, he does not try to fix all the poverty. Sorry, I'm losing my place. All the sickness, all the need, the political situation. He allows that to be, but he speaks grace and he speaks salvation and redemption within the context because there is a greater hope than this life itself. Now, this tendency to fix has become a real issue, so some of the reserve we feel as Africans or as two-third worlders is so many people have come to fix us that, oh Lord, please don't bring another person to fix us. We've been fixed so many times, we are a real mess now. Please allow us to be us. Allow us to find God and to find faith in the reality of our need. Vulnerable Mission, he just described it. Don't come and fix me. Don't try to solve me. You can't live with my problem, so don't try to fix it so you feel better about yourself or so you can live better. Come along the side. Cry with me. Walk with me. Covenant with me. That's from the side of somebody in Africa who's crying out for a vulnerable mission, isn't it? Do you think? Now, As I shared with you before, when I went to Cambodia, I was led to believe that to go to be a missionary, I had to be a power broker. Remember when I was in Cambodia, I lived just like the people. I had hardly any money. I lived with Cambodians for 6 years, but when it was time to go to Cambodia, I was led to believe that I had to fix people. And I needed money to fix people. And I needed to do big things. I needed to go into somebody else's cultural context and be a power broker, arrange the economy, figure out how to take care of their orphans. And here's a comment by someone who works with missionaries that are sending out, such as Africa sending out missionaries, Latin America sending out missionaries, and this is what he says. Our missionaries enter cultures more like economic power brokers than they do mystics, faith healers, and intercessors. Such a missionary paradigm and practice is a lost art. I think that's why we're here today, to say, whatever you want to call it, doing mission in vulnerability is a lost art. But what if we sent missionaries whose first question was not, where can we best spend our money here, but rather, what can I ask my God on your behalf? What if our missionaries were known more for their prayers, their intimacy with God, and their spiritual wisdom than their programs and their projects and their resources? Some are calling this a return to the apostolic way of mission. Remember, we were talking about how do we help students and missions? Should we go back to the history of missionaries? Sure. Let's look at the history of missions. But let's go even farther back. What about the apostolic missions from the Bible? By which they mean the simplicity and power of the early missionaries of the first century. This was a mission from a position of vulnerability. Mission that had to prove its value to the community over time, not buy its way into acceptance as quickly as possible. If I go to places like Cambodia and I use a lot of money, I'm buying my acceptance into the community. I could get a community leader to commit to me to be friends with me in 2 days if I come as an economic power broker and I offer to do a school for you. But the Cambodian following me, who only has a bowl of fruit and maybe can teach you something like a little bit of gardening, doesn't stand a chance, because I can buy my way into acceptance, make myself needed, but they can't. So I'm setting them up for failure. Let's pick apart David Taylor's words, not to do. Maybe you want to write this down. This is what a vulnerable mission doesn't do, missionary. Not to do. Don't be economic power brokers. Don't put yourself in that position. Not to do. Ask questions that focus on your status and resources. Oh, I'm here. What do you need? What can I provide for you? Not to do. Not to be known for our programs and our resources. You know, in Cambodia, there were Filipino missionaries there, and they couldn't bring the bundle of money that American missionaries could bring. And they said to me, Jean, no Cambodian wants to work with us. They all want to work with the Americans or the Europeans because they have money, and we're a bit more like them, less economically successful, and they don't want anything to do with us. I don't like it. Next one. Not to do, according to David Taylor, position of power and expertise. Don't do missions in a position of power and I know more than you. I'm more spiritual than you. I'll tell you, some Cambodian Buddhists are more spiritual than American nominal Christians. Another one, don't buy your acceptance into the community. That's what a vulnerable missionary should not do. Now I want to go through what we should do. We should be faith healers and intercessors. They use the word mystics, meaning be spiritual people, spiritual leaders, examples and models. Second one, ask questions that get the focus off of us onto God. See the opposites? Next one, be known for your prayers, intimacy with God, and spiritual wisdom, rather than your projects and your resources. Another one, instead of position of power and expertise, what to do, come from a position of simplicity and vulnerability. And the last one, instead of buying our acceptance into the community, do not prove your value to the community over time. I mean, prove your value to the community over time. We've talked a lot about, a lot of our examples have been what's not working, right? Or outcomes of unhealthy dependency, outcomes of overpouring local resources. I'd like to read you a conversation of the beauty of what happens when somebody from a local country is not doing, trying to share the gospel because somebody else over here in another country is paying for it, or telling them that they need to use the English language because that's somehow superior. This is a conversation between a Muslim background pastor. He was a Muslim, but now he's a believer. So they call him Muslim background believer. Because why not just call a Muslim a Christian? Because you know what Muslims think Christians are? MTV, pornography. See, because they think all Americans are Christians, and we think all, because they don't separate religion and identity. So they don't call themselves Christians, because then if you say, I'm a Christian, you're saying, I like pornography, I like to drink, I like billboards with, you know, naked women, I like to dance to hip-hop and MTV. That's the image. So if they can't call themselves Christians, they call themselves believers, followers of Jesus. We refer to them as missionaries, Muslim background believers. So this Muslim background believer had a house church. He was a pastor of a house church. And according to the law, they had to register their house church with the government. So he went to the government, and he went to the particular department where they register churches, house churches. And lo and behold, when he met the officer who takes the applications and does the registration, was an old friend of his from way back. Now this friend was a Muslim. They weren't a believer in Jesus. And he began to dialogue. So this is what the officer said, and I'm going to read the dialogue. Officer, the pastor's name is Hakim. So the officer says, so Hakim, what is the address to your church building? Hakim, it meets in my house. Officer, okay, but since you are a pastor, where's your office then? Hakim, I don't have an office. Officer, okay, but how much is your salary and who pays it? Hakim, I don't have a salary. Officer, what? No salary? How do you live? Hakim, you know, since you've known me, that my wife and I are school teachers. The salary we make as school teachers is enough for us. Officer, okay, but what about a car? Or a motorcycle, or a travel account, or something that you get for being the pastor of this group. You must get something, some benefit. Hakim, I don't get any of those things. Officer, you mean to tell me that you lead this church without any kind of pay, without any material benefits? That doesn't make sense to me. Why would you waste your time being the pastor? Hakim, I do it because I believe in Jesus. Officer, you must really believe in Jesus, because there doesn't seem to be any other reason. That's the outcome when we're cautious of not using money to push. It looks like America's paying for Christianity, and those in other countries are just hirelings of what were our agendas. Roland Allen, an English missionary, has since gone to be with the Lord for quite a while, but has written this very powerful thing. Nothing is so weakening as the habit of depending upon others for things which we ought to supply for ourselves. Nothing more undermines the spirit which should express itself in spontaneous activity. Now here's the question. And this is what ultimately Terry, who was the Buddhist Cambodian, was asking in a way. How can a man propagate, a religion or faith which he cannot support and which he cannot expect those he addresses to be able to support? I think if it were flipped and the Muslims were coming to America and they started to visit Jim in his community, and you kind of see it happen. You know, they're going to his house. You don't know what they're doing at his house. You're wondering why they go in and out, spending time with Jim, and he's in this community. And then eventually you see that Jim is driving a new car, and his children are going to another school, different, and you're wondering, what's all this going on? And he comes to your house and says, I want to tell you about some good news about somebody called Muhammad. What will you think of him? That he's doing the bidding of who? That he's not sincerely sharing his faith, but somehow he was bought into that religion. And he's just a foreigner, he's just an agent of those pushing his buttons from behind. Well, it happens in other places in the world when we flip it around. In closing, there was a good and sincere man who was searching for sustainability. And he didn't know how to find sustainability, so he went to a wise man. You're wise, you have a little gray. And they had mint tea together. They had milk tea together. And he asked the wise man, how do I find sustainability in my own local situation? And the wise man said, there's a village over there that I want you to journey to. And when you're there, I want you to stop in three shops. So he followed the instructions of the wise man and began his journey. And he went to the three shops. The first shop he went to, he walked in, and all he saw were reels of wire. The shop was selling reels of wire. And he was so disappointed. What does this have to do with sustainability? And he walked away. And then he went to the next shop, and they were selling pieces of wood. And he's like, wire, pieces of wood? I don't understand what the wise man is talking about. What does this have to do with sustainability? Then he went to the third shop, and he saw some roughly shaped metal. They were selling pieces of metal. And the same thing, why are they selling metal? What does this have to do with sustainability? He was so disappointed, he put his head down and started to walk out of the village. As he was walking out of the village, he heard this beautiful music. This beautiful music. Where is that coming from? It's beautiful. I think I'm going to just go back a few steps back into the village and see what that is. And he goes back. And he sees a man playing an instrument made out of wire, wood, and metal. He understood that sustainability is the union of everything that has already been given to us. The countries that we're working in, they have resources. But we need to help them mobilize their local resources. Instead of saying, we'll bring it in for you. We need to be, a vulnerable mission is like a wise man. He sends that person out in that country to show them how to create, to use what they have to create what they need. Just like Hakim and his local house church. And he was credible. Because he could say, nobody's paying me. I believe in Jesus so much that I'm willing to sacrifice for this faith because it is real and it's for you too. So that's what I have to say. Ethics of change. I personally don't want to turn around 30 years from now and say, what did we do? Jim, you've been talking about the gospel of prosperity. That gospel of prosperity that's all over Africa, they believe that Christianity is the way to prosperity. It's rampant. And people in Africa were missionaries. What happened? This is out of control. But as we turn and we look and say ethics of change, where did that mindset come in the first place? Where did it come from? Do we have any responsibility in it along with them? So that's my challenge. A vulnerable missionary is somebody who doesn't wait for 30 years to turn around and see what damage we left along the way. Because my book, We Are Not the Hero, I didn't turn 30 years later, but maybe 8 years later, and I said, wow, look at the damage I've left. To be honest, everything that I tried to do with money failed, for the most part. If I helped one person, this pastor got jealous. But when I left money out of it, it seemed to go quite well, because the Holy Spirit made up the difference instead of the center of the wheel. Jim, anything? You want to? What time are we supposed to end? 9 o'clock, was it?
Yeah.
I'm thinking that we should dialogue a little bit, because I threw out a whole pile of stuff. And maybe we can do this by having a few people come put some chairs in the front and create like we did a panel. So it's a little bit of an organized dialogue. I'm going to have Jim come. Ralph? Are you here? Come forth, yeah. Tim? And I'm going to add somebody out of the group. So I'm going to add Peter. So we have a little bit more going on here besides just the organizers of the conference. And I'm not going to sit on the panel because I'm afraid you have too many hard questions. Because I brought the subject up, I will participate. But I'm also going to kind of be the roaming microphone. So questions. These will probably be your last time to ask. Well, not really. There'll be more times. But we're getting nearer and nearer to the end. And as we've processed, we've learned more and more about what vulnerable mission looks like, which is instead of trying to do mission on the inside, bringing our outside resources in as much as possible, we want to mobilize local resources. Instead of me going and saying, well, it seems like Cambodians in Phnom Penh like to speak English, so I might as well speak English. Rather, as a vulnerable missionary, I'm going to get to know the language so I can get to know the worldview. Because without the language, you will never know the heart of somebody's worldview. I really believe that. So that's what we've been talking about for 2 days. So who wants to start with a question? Anything you want at this time. It doesn't have to be what I spoke on, just in the case of vulnerable mission and how it affects things. Does anybody have a question that you want to ask or a comment? You can participate. You can say, well, this caused me to think about this.
Yes, I've been very interested in what you've said. Paul, of course, was a tent maker, wasn't he, on his missionary journeys? And he could say that he hadn't been supported or relied upon anyone. He was doing it by his own endeavors in order to support his missionary activity. But there were gifts from the churches, weren't there? And I wonder, I was thinking more from a charitable point of view, that we're sending money to places like South Africa to help people up, create little industries, little home industries. Is that not similar, detrimental to them being self-sufficient?
We have two kind of aims. Paul, who seemed to work with his hands, but then did get some support. So how does that fit into vulnerable mission? And second, if our money's going out in to help them stand up, what does that look like in regards to vulnerable mission?
Okay, thank you very much. Paul was a tent maker. Why was he a tent maker? Because he didn't want to be saying to folks all the time, I need your money. Particularly if you're in a context in which he had to say hard things. Sometimes he had to say hard things to people. For example, if you find a group of people who are practicing a lot of adultery, and for them it's normal, you say, in this church, no adulterers. They hate you. They won't give you the money. Now, if you depend on their money, you can't be honest. Whereas if you have a source of funds that's other than from them, then I think you can be in that way more honest. That's just one of the aspects of the importance of tent making.
Paul wasn't a tent maker all the time. He was a tent maker in the situations where it was important for him to do it, either for his own keep or as an example to the people with whom he was working. There were times when he was supported by others in his ministry. And we don't have to be worried about being supported in our ministry from that point of view, if it is the right thing and the people who are there. The question, sorry.
Couple things about Paul, though. He did not use money to support churches that he planted. He never there's no example where Paul himself planted a church and then subsidized paying for their pastor, paying for their building. It was self-sustaining from the get-go. And also something that triggers my thinking is that who supported Paul? The churches he planted. So if somebody in Kenya says to Jim, well, we'd like to support you because you work so hard amongst us, that's one thing. But if an American supports a Kenyan pastor, then that's a different story. And I don't see Paul doing that. I don't see him being supported by somebody way, way, way. He wasn't even supported by Jerusalem, right? Or the sending church didn't support him, Antioch. But his churches he planted supported him. So that's just one thing I wanted to bring up.
We've seen a number of examples where outsiders have supported pastors in their work. Very well-meaning outsiders, very well-meaning, we want to support this man with his work. And when you actually look at what is happening on the ground, the elements of jealousy which have developed, the elements of superiority, the elements of I want that for myself, so I will join that church because he's got an income and I want a bit of that myself. It happens a tremendous amount. We've seen examples, particularly most recently probably in the north of Malawi, where people made it their job to provide the pastor's salary so that the pastor could get on with their work. It's brilliant, isn't it? But when it's not related to the local situation, it causes an awful lot of problems. And I must say that one of the things that I'm most fervent about, in certain circles anyway, is to say, please do not pay a pastor's salary from outside. Pastor needs to be paid from inside, from the people who he is serving. And then the ministry is going to go much better. But that's one of the big things, I think.
I'm interested just to look at it from the other side of the coin, that the question of receiving money from locals as a missionary when you're working, one of the more humbling things is to have needy people be generous to you. And that's a real challenge. You know, you could pay for the meal for the whole family and they put their best food on the table in front of you. That is a real challenge. And that is very humbling, to graciously and thankfully allow them to be generous. Examining your own motivations, not leaving room for misinterpretation, but then probably not saying anything anyway because it'll be misinterpreted. Right? It can be really complex. In terms of a missionary in a context either paying or being paid or so forth, I keep coming back to the question of working out who you work for, because the people who are around you in a context, there will be all sorts of different opinions, and it's very important to have clear whose opinion counts in terms of what you do. And so if there's actually, to give you an idea, I was under quite a lot of pressure to work part-time because everybody else would have to work part-time, right? fair enough. I accept that challenge. It's an interesting one to reflect on. But in terms of the organisation we were working for, our organisation had said we provide people, not money, and we don't want our missionary to be a financial burden on you. We want you to raise the money to be self-supporting as soon as possible. We don't want you to pay that to us, because we want you to save it up so that you can pay a national with that money. Right? Now, there could be a legitimate place in there to receive some of that money while the pump was being primed, to cover some of the expenses, to help the movement of finances grow over time. But in the end, you don't want to be, you're not there to be money grabbing, you're there to be helping them grow in financial resourcefulness. Right? And even into that context, the woman's might is more important than the self-righteous who's got a fortune to toss around. And so to recognise God's values in money, in the complexities, is a real challenge. Now, that hasn't responded at all to your question, to sending money for others.
Yeah. The effect of receiving from poorer people than yourself is quite mind-blowing. And I remember on one occasion we had been asked to speak at a church, again in Malawi, and we had a great time. And after the service, they gave us an envelope. And I said, we want to say thank you. And he knew me, and he said, you've got to take it. Because if you don't take it, you are depriving us of the blessing that God gives to those who give. And that was a very humbling experience. We've had it happen three times to us, I think, in our ministry, where people have done that. And I'm not talking about a £5 note. I'm talking about $100 that they had given us. And it brings in the point that they were accusing us that if we didn't take the money, we were stifling their blessing. And I think one of the things we have to be very, very careful in what we're giving, even in development, in helping people, giving people a hand up, which I think we do need to do. I'm not arguing against that. But we have got to be very careful that in trying to help people, give them a hand up, we are not stifling either their own ability, because they don't feel, well, I don't need to do it because somebody else is going to do it, or their blessing because they're doing what they feel God wants them to do. So I think we have to be very careful of that.
We'll move on to any other questions. Anybody else? Yes. We'll go back here and then we'll go up front. In the back, yeah. I'm sorry, I don't know your name. Yeah. Oh, no. we'll just pre-groan and get it over with. Oh, those are frogs, not monks.
Thank you. there's not a question in there, but there's, yeah, statement. And we already grown, so that's, we got that over with.
Not that we would.
Yeah. On the other hand, Derek, we were hearing earlier on this morning of the hope in economic development, and it was putting another side to the issue. And I think you're very right that the source of resources is in the soil in many parts of Africa. The problem is the way in which Africa is being raped illegally by all of the... I'm thinking of Congo in particular, the east of Congo, where people whose hearts are not right are destroying the... are stealing, taking and destroying that country. And to me, yes, that's important. The minerals are important, but it is the heart of man that is more important. And if we are dealing with hope, how can we actually produce the hope in the lives of these people and see the change, which will actually, could eventually bring the economic development, but it's the heart of man which is actually more important, I would like to say, than the economic development.
Thank you for those responses. I thought I'd just add something that rather shocked me some years ago when I was in Zambia. I was staying with a Zambian person who I guess didn't expect to have a British person staying in the same house. So what I found was when we'd go and visit other Westerners, he would kind of stay for the minimum time and then leave. And he seemed to avoid spending time with Westerners. So one day I asked him, why is it that you are the Zambian and you avoid the white people? Well, he said, my people, when they see me with you, they understand that I'm after your money. So in order to maintain my reputation, I have to avoid you. Now that kind of struck me a bit hard. You mean I'm going to the Zambians because I take God's word to them, and their colleagues know when I turn up, I'm there to give them money, and the person wants to be my friend because they want money. In other words, if someone befriends me, everyone else will understand they're after my money. In a similar but slightly different way, a colleague of mine in Kenya, who's a very productive, small-scale farmer, and very hard-working, he came to me and he said, Jim, there's some folks coming and they want to help some of the farmers in this village. They are donors and they want to give us a boost and assistance and loans and such like. Now I thought very carefully about, okay, I don't know whether he took my advice or not. I mean, he did what he wanted to do, but what was I going to say to him? I could say, well, take advantage of the money they're bringing. What I realized was that if other folks saw that he was benefiting from that donor money, they would no longer give him the respect as a person who's hardworking and built up what he has by himself. And once someone's put money into your system, they start pulling the strings with the money they put in and could actually disrupt what he's doing in very unhelpful ways. So my advice, my honest advice to him was, when they come, avoid them, because then going to cause you more problems than they're worth. Now, I gave that advice and I thought about it afterwards.
Fred, did you have a question?
Most of the presentations so far have linked that statement up there with the poor. I'd like to ask you, is the concept of vulnerable mission flexible enough to reach other levels of society? And if so, can you give some examples of where it's worked?
Interesting question. Now, I'd just like to suggest that if you go to higher levels of society in parts of Africa, for example, you're likely to meet people speaking European languages. If you want to find out what's really going on amongst those people, engage them in their own language. Then you'll get a much clearer opportunity of sharing a gospel that's not a prosperity gospel.
I think the language question is probably obvious in terms of different levels of society. I think at the university level, the government level, if you're going to engage seriously, you at least pay the courtesy of speaking their language rather than expecting them to speak yours. Unless, of course, they do, and they do fluently. Some do, some don't. But the definition of heart language we had the other day, I think, was absolutely brilliant. The language a couple fight with in their bedroom or out in the field, right? I think that's the best definition of heart language that I've ever come across. In terms of resources, people are very perceptive. Poor people are perceptive in their own way because poor people know how to use money. Extraordinary. I've never seen people who can stretch money like poor people. Not necessarily people at the bottom of the social pile, but people who actually are in their poverty for one reason or another that's outside their control. In terms of wealthy people, I think I mentioned in a group today, just about every country you can think of, there are people in those countries who are 10 times wealthier than any Australian missionary who's ever going to go and work there, right? Mega wealth that we can't imagine in Australia. Now, just to be relating at those sorts of levels, you're not going to be throwing your money around or something like that to try and impress at that context. I'm interested by the question of gaining respect and platform without buying it. That came up in the talk, and I had the question of how long do you think that takes?
It takes as long as it would take a local person to make a friend with a local person. But it'll even take longer since you have, depends if you know the language or not. But what it means, I don't know how long it takes, but I know what it means. It means that if I go to Cambodia, a lot of times as missionaries, we decide how we'll minister to the community by what's comfortable for us. So, I'll set up an English center. I'll rent a little building. I'll teach English, my favorite language. And even though in Cambodia they're saying Jesus is the foreigner's God, I'm going to teach them about God in English, free English, by the way. And they're going to come to my place where I've decorated it and put books, my Western comfortable comfort zone. And they come to me and I'll tell them about Jesus. Doesn't take but 2 weeks. But what it means is I don't create my comfort zone and invite people into my comfort zone to share Jesus with them. But what it means is I'm going to have to swing in a hammock for as many months as it takes until I learn the language and speak to heart issues. There was a man in Cambodia that was working in the floating villages. They're floating because they're along the water, so they build their villages on the water. And he was an outsider, a missionary, and he was going to the floating villages constantly. And he had a boat driver that was local Cambodian or Vietnamese. And the boat driver became a believer in Jesus Christ, and he would watch this missionary, and he finally said to the missionary, "Everything you're telling these Cambodians makes no sense to them." And he said, "What do you mean? All that you're sharing the gospel, they don't get it, because you're speaking from your own experience and worldview." "Well, what do you want me to talk about then?" "Talk about ghosts." "Ghosts." So he went along, and that evening they went into the homes of about 5-6 Cambodian people. And this missionary didn't take the advice.
He was going on and on about all of the ways we lead people to Christ and the Western thinking. And all the people, just one man was listening, the rest were all asleep. The elderly started to... And all of a sudden, the guy poked him and he said, "Now, ghost." So this missionary said, "I want to tell you a ghost story from the Bible." And they all woke up and they all sat like this. And he told about the man living in the tombs among the dead, naked and running free. And all that to say that it takes time, but will be effective. So it means sitting and having tea. It means going in the field and maybe learning how to plow the rice. So the difference is that buying your acceptance is instant. Basically, we make ourselves needed. If they need me, then they'll listen to the gospel. So if I go and I teach you English, you'll need me. You won't persecute me because you need me. And I'll teach you English, and sure enough, I'll teach you Christ. Because when you make people needing me through my resources and my English, you're going to pay attention because there's a string attached. But when a Cambodian goes and can't offer that, they can't buy their way into acceptance. They have to work their way slowly. So it could take years. But once somebody comes to Jesus Christ through that, they'll stay through thick and thin. But whenever I led a Cambodian to Jesus fast, because I was meeting a need with the gospel. Here's the gospel and here's a bag of rice. That person would inevitably come to say, "I'm a Christian," but the first time they had a crisis, they ran right back to Buddhism because the gospel didn't hit change them at the worldview. It just superficially conformed. So depends what result. The faster you go, the shallower it is. The slower you go, the deeper it is.
In South America, a good asado cooks very slow.
In Latin America, the asado, the roasted meat, the slower you cook it, the better it tastes.
I think we're getting the message. A few years ago, I went to a conference where there was a Dalit speaker. And apparently, I learned at the time, great numbers of Dalits are turning to Christ. Now, I don't suppose that that's because of money, but it's the doctrine of self-worth to be found in Jesus, that these people are at the lowest level in society in India. And when someone comes along and tells them, they're valuable to God, valuable to Jesus, they get an immediate personal uplift, don't they? And seemingly that's happening. I don't know whether anybody here has got any experience of that, but certainly at the time we learned that great, great numbers are turning to Christ because they now are finding personal worth in Him and faith in Him.
Sorry, I'll try to keep this comment brief because it is a comment that I'm not in a panel, but I think you had talked about, you know, the idea of sending money over to start a business or to help them become self-sustaining. It's indirectly related, but I do have some Cambodian recollection and experience that deals somewhat indirectly with that. But I've seen many advertisements to churches and Christians in the West for starting rabbit business, goat business. Goat's a terrible idea in Cambodia, even though it's a great idea in Africa. But anyway, self-sustaining, the idea, you know, using the word self-sustaining, create business so they can create income. In all the cases that I'm aware of, it was a business model that was dreamt up by a Westerner, a Western missionary or a Western development worker who wanted, and it didn't sustain itself in the end. I'm not saying it can't go right, but I'm saying I'm not aware of Cambodian examples that have actually gone into a sustaining business. And as far as, you know, we've probably all received something in the mail or seen something somewhere at some point about, you know, support a church planter, not even their salary, but just the gas for their motorcycle or to buy them a bicycle. Or I remember when Food for the Hungry, we wrapped up operations in one area of the country because we felt like it was time to leave. People were becoming dependent upon us and not the Spirit, and so it was time to leave. And earlier on in our operations, we had been buying bicycles for high school kids that graduated and went into high school. They'd get a bicycle. Every villager I went to say, hey, we're going to be leaving in a year, first question was always, who's going to buy our bicycles after that? That was always their first question. We've probably all heard of schemes where they, like, we've all heard of this organization, but in Cambodia, I think they still do it. They pay $30 a month for gas for church planters to put gas into their motorcycles to go follow up with churches out in the countryside. I've had staff who were on that scheme, and one of them, who was a very unusually honest man, said, John, I never lied in my life until I signed up for that. And then I just knew the pressure was so great to report new churches, more people coming to Christ. I have to keep this $30 a month coming. I never lied in my life until I signed up for that. And he just said, I couldn't live with myself. After 2 years, I stopped it. And so he actually turned incredible moral courage to do something like that when you're a rural, poor Cambodian. As an alternative to that, I know, I don't know if it's still going on now, but it was doing for at least a couple of years. I've been out of the country for a while now, but another Christian pastor learned how to do micro savings. We've all heard of microfinance or microcredit. Micro savings is different in that there's no outside money. It's they're saving their own money. Okay. In his church, he started a micro savings group. They saved their money every month together. And more church members got involved to where most of the church was involved. And when you save your money together and loan it to each other and you pay money back into the pot, that money grows. Okay. And normally what you would do is you would take the profit from the interest and divide it out at the end of the year to all the people. Well, they agreed, we're not going to make any money from this. We're not going to lose any money, but we're not going to make any. What we're going to do with this money, this profit that we make, we're going to use that to pay for gas for our church members to go out to the countryside and to follow up with daughter churches that we're planting. And he did this, it was his idea, the pastor's idea, executed with local resources through the local church, and it was accomplishing the very same effect as outside money without causing formerly ethical Christians to lie, okay? And it was done locally with local resources because it was dreamed up. It was God gave a pastor this idea, and he ran with it, and his church went behind it. Same effect. One's local resources, one is outside resources, and very, very different end result.
If you listen to some of the things we're saying, we're almost saying, keep your money to yourself, don't give your money overseas. I don't agree. The church is a worldwide family. And we need to be interdependent. When we are interdependent, what we have got that somebody else needs, we need to be prepared to give so that we can receive what we need from them. The way in which we give what we have is actually the point in hand. We need to give judiciously. There are we've heard horror stories here of where money has been misspent. There are situations, many of them, where money has been used well to actually lift people up from where they are, and it's continued. We used to do it in very, very small scale with pastors' wives and helping pastors' wives to my wife was involved in doing that, but helping them with their own projects, not suggesting projects to them, but seeing what projects they wanted to do and then helping them to get to a certain stage in that. And we went to a church in Kenya, and we were involved with 8 or 9 of these wives in helping them with these projects. And we went back 7 years later, and of those 8 or 9, only one had failed, and the all others were going. They weren't all doing the same project now, that they had changed. But they had been able to use the money that had been given to them. So, yes, that while I agree with you, we've got to be very judicious in the way in which we spend the money. Please, I don't think in Vulnerable Mission we're actually saying, please, no money. But don't depend on it, and it's got to be judiciously used. And it's got to be the idea of the people who are coming. They need to be able to say, this is what we need, this is what we will do.
Yeah, I think.
I wouldn't want to argue against development, but I wouldn't want to argue against development because there's been a lot of thinking put in it by Derek, for example. But I think there are dangers, and Vulnerable Mission as a sort of discipline has made me aware of those dangers. Wealth differences in particular do produce problems. Now, in the Middle Ages, there wasn't much of a problem with wealth differences between the very rich and the very poor because they believed that they were put in those positions by God. With our sort of society, the wealth difference is allied to expectation that you can better yourself. So when you see a wealth difference, it becomes a source of dissatisfaction. And that disturbs relationships. So when we go over to these countries, they see us coming from a very rich situation. And if we bring in that wealth, it produces differences. I think human beings are sensitive to not the absolute value of wealth, but when there are differences between people. Once your needs have been satisfied, after that, what the big problem is how can you compete and use your wealth as a trophy against someone else? Wealth becomes for value for its trophy value rather than its intrinsic value. And that is very important in human relationships. Now, when this gets in the way of relationships between people in other countries, I think they see the motivations underlying those wealth differences disturbs our relationships with people in Africa. So I think the lesson is we've got to concentrate on relationships, perhaps let the development thing continue, but not let it get in the way of our preaching and our relationships.
Thank you. Just to add to that, I think we have a problem in Africa, and a rather serious problem, that if you have the kind of skin colour that we have and you talk the way we talk, our predecessors have given us a terrible reputation. As the folks know, as we've heard, our business is money. And if you go and visit someone, I've heard of accounts of a Brit going into a slum in Nairobi to visit the people, maybe they're drunk teen, they walked out. That night a gang goes and even kills the people there in order to find the money that they assume the white people have left. Our reputation is a disaster in that sense. And that being a disaster, in some respects, means there needs to be some serious action to try and rectify it. This is our action, it's not them. You know, this isn't a conference, come along Africans, we'll tell you how to do it. This is telling our folks how to do it. Are you money? Is that what you're always good at? Do you want to mess up everybody by offering them money? How many of your friends here in Norwich do you go to and you say, I'm here because I want to give you money? That kind of behavior makes life extremely difficult for anyone who comes from, say, the UK and actually wants to relate to the people as other people relate to people. No, I'm not here with money. I'm here to share the gospel. I'm here to pray with you. I'm here just to visit you because I like you. So what we say in the Alliance of Vulnerable Mission is that these money issues that are being discussed all over the mission world, seems to me, and all over the development world, great stuff, folks, fantastic, keep the discussion going. Does everybody have to be doing it? We're on it now. Why are we on it? Because in the West we're stuck on this. We think the thing that we have of value is our money. And we forget that the thing that we have of value is God's word. And if we think that what we have of value is our money, we're actually missing God's word. Okay, 99.999% of people who go to Africa go there to share the money from the West. Can there be 0.001% who are not going to be labeled with that and can instead move as in a sense as the African people do? They don't do this kind of thing. It would not always have to be different. Well, we're from Britain, we always give out money. And that to me is the issue. Is there room for some people to do that? Will we in the UK allow that? When you send someone to work in Cambodia and they say, yes, I want to love the Cambodian people, but I'm not going to help them with money. Do we say, well, then there's no point in you going? Because there's one occasion when I was in a church in Zambia, and they know this habit of missionaries, and I was going to take over from a retired missionary, but they had their meeting of the pastors, 60 pastors present, and the leader of the church said, this missionary has no money. What use is a missionary without money? Tell him to go home. Is that what we're good for? No wonder no one else can do what we're doing. So there may be great things we can do with money. Can there be some who actually work without money? In the biblical way, instead of having to always be engrossed in this discussion where really what we're saying is not we've got the gospel, it's we've got the money and we feel guilty. We want to share it with you, and when we do, we'll mess you up.
The question of motivation for people being involved for me was really significant, working with university students in northern Argentina. So the classic way of getting university students together was sport, food or music, right? And then afterwards, not only university students, but young people in the churches. And then afterwards you'd try and Bible bash them over the head for about 10 minutes while they were quiet, and then they'd go back to their sport, music or food. So I was determined to do something where the only motivating factor was God's word and nothing else. So we simply went out into the universities and asked people if they'd like to read the New Testament. Now, I was low status in that context. I wasn't a power figure. I didn't have a public teaching platform. I was in a sense a despised missionary, right, even within the churches. And so we just got the students simply to ask the question, would you like to read the New Testament together with other university students? That context, the response staggered us. When I say us, the students were out doing it with their friends. We were using the Swedish Bible study method that you'll find noted in Jean's book, or you can find an article that I wrote on a few years ago. We got to a situation where we had 18 Bible study groups. Half of the members of the Bible study groups weren't Christians. There was no food, there was no music, and there was no sport. The only motivating factor was, would you like to read the New Testament together with another student? And we had as many non-Christians in our Bible reading groups as we had Christians in the Bible reading groups. I wasn't running most of them. One group of 12 had 3 Christians, 9 non-Christians in it, and amongst them they decided to read the book of Revelation. I nearly croaked. They settled too, they did it, they got all sorts of great things out of it as God spoke to them. At the end of the day, we need to make sure that what we do really reflects what it is that we believe and what it is that we say that we believe. So there's an absolute coherence between our values, our convictions and our actions, so that at that point our actions aren't completely contradicting what it is that we're saying, that what we're teaching. And it's a fundamental principle of Protestantism, that in Protestantism we believe the Bible creates, present tense, the church, because God speaks through his word. Unlike the Catholic Church that we were talking about in Latin America, where the church created the Bible. Right? So our question of authority was different. So our coherence was simply to pray, because God is the one who speaks through his word, invite people to read the word, and let the word loose, let it do its job. Let people work out what it looked like as they applied it in their context and in their setting. I didn't give them applications of it. They had to go and find it for themselves and work it out for themselves. Never forget a non-Christian doctor coming along in a group that read John chapter 3. He said, the application of this passage is obvious. He said, you've got to be born again. I thought that was pretty good.
Can I just follow it through a bit?
Well, we're just going to close.
Okay.
I just asked Jean, am I chairing or is she chairing? Because I chaired and invited her, and now she's chairing the panel. So I think I was waiting for the chairman to come and close for us. And then I realized that I was the chairman. So time is going on. We've had a long day. It's 9:15. So I think we can say thank you very much indeed for the visitors who've come and joined us for this discussion, which I hope has been of value to you. It's been of great interest to me. And it's great to have had everybody here. So I think it'd be appropriate to close in prayer. Just to say for those who are coming back tomorrow, 8:00, please arrive. 8:15, we'll